And you are listening to Fanboy Versus, a special edition. JD and Chris McFeely here. Today we're talking to someone who's been in comic books for quite a while now. They have a long and great history as far as comics go. And we're very proud to welcome them to the program today. Welcome Dan Juergens.
Hey, guys.
How you doing today?
Very good, and you?
Excellent, excellent. So maybe for our listeners that don't know or aren't familiar, who is Dan Juergens, and how did you get where you are now?
Oh, gosh, who am I? you know, yeah, let's see. In terms of credits, I have written and drawn, you know, all sorts of things at DC. Probably, you know, most notably Superman, wrote through Zero Hour, drew the Marvel DC crossover, wrote and drew a Superman Fantastic Four crossover, currently writing and drawing Booster Gold, just got done with Time Masters, which I wrote and drew at Marvel, wrote and drew Spider-Man, wrote Thor, wrote and drew Captain America. I mean, it's a pretty long list.
And how did it all begin? Where does Dan Juergens come from? How did you make it into comics?
As a kid, I was always very, very interested in comics. And as I got older, you know, I kind of was aiming toward other things, but maintained a strong interest in comics. And at one point, kind of the condensed version of the story is that Mike Grell, who had created, written, and drawn Warlord for DC, was making a personal appearance. And I stopped and showed him my work, and it also just so happened they were kind of in the process of looking for a new artist on the title. And, you know, a couple months later, I started on Warlord, which was, as I say, being published by DC, and I've been in it ever since.
Well, one of course, your more favorite creations and a personal favorite of mine is Booster Gold. Kind of maybe talk through, like, what was your inspiration behind the Booster character?
Booster was created, you know, back around 1984. And at that time, first of all, we need to step back just a bit, because I think it's important to note that the world in which Booster was created in 1984 was quite a lot different than it is today. And we start with the recognition that Booster is very concerned about, you know, popularity, making money. If he's a superhero, everything else. He's not a hero for hire, but he gets into the merchandising end of things. And it goes back to 1984 during the Olympic Games. Back then, Olympic athletes could not make money from their endeavors in the Olympics. They could afterwards, provided they were never going to be amateurs again. And the announcers were talking about a particular athlete who had already negotiated a contract that was going to pay him, you know, several million dollars once he was done and after he won his medal. That does not sound unique. At the time, that was unique because, you know, first of all, you had to be an amateur, but more than anything, people just weren't that crass.
Mm-hmm.
So that kind of got the ball rolling, and that combined with a few other ideas led to Booster Gold.
Tell us a little more about the development of Booster and his series. Where did the ideas come from? And Booster is hot right now. Booster has a lot of attention. We'll get to that later on when we talk about the things that are in Booster's future. But let's talk a little bit about Booster's past right now and how your work on that series was getting to write a self-created title like that.
Well, there are a couple of things that go into Booster in particular and something, that kind of effort overall. First of all, once again, if you go back to that time, a lot of what was happening in comics was sort of what we refer to now as the grim and gritty movement, be it Dark Knight, be it Watchmen. I mean, many books were kind of turning in that direction. So, you know, rather than go that way where everybody else sort of was, I wanted to do something that was a little lighter. I mean, obviously, Booster as a character has a commercially crass sort of tone to it and same kind of appeal, but I just wanted to do something different. You know, at that time, I think DC had maybe been publishing Blue Devil for a year, But that was really back when neither Marvel or DC were really able to publish new heroes and make them stick. I mean, even ever since, there hasn't been a lot of that. It's sort of like relaunching a book with a, you know, the same name of a previous character and making that work somehow. Mm-hmm. But new properties really weren't coming out and having any, you know, stick-to-itiveness, if you will. So that was the goal behind creating Booster and taking it to DC. One, I wanted it to be something different than what was going on in a lot of the mainstream titles at the time. I wanted it to be different than what DC was generally publishing at the time, and I think it was. And I think that if you go back to those days, it was unique. Also around then, Dick Giordano, who had a long and storied career in the business, primarily as an anchor, was managing editor at DC, and I sat down with him and I said, okay, you know, look, here's the deal. And, you know, I'd been at DC maybe a year and a half at that point and hadn't written much at all. But I described Booster to him, and I described what the character would be, you know, what the book would be like, and more importantly, how it would be different. And Dick bought it on the spot, and here we are, you know, 25 years later, we're still up and running. With, you know, some interruption in between, but we're still going strong. Mm.
Well, like I said, we'll talk more about Booster's upcoming future, but I know to a lot of people, you're really... what you're most known for is your work on Superman. What are you
one
most
proud of? One of those aforementioned interruptions.
Yeah. What are you say what you're most proud of as far as what you worked on and what were you part of during your time with Superman?
I don't know if I could isolate it into most proud of. I think there would be several different things. Obviously, and this is in no particular order, but obviously, you know, the first thing that will come to mind for most people is the death of Superman itself, which, you know, is sort of a thematic element, sales success, that will never be replicated in this industry. I mean, it just, you know, went everywhere, and it was remarkably successful in terms of sales. And I still say now that if you go back to the death of Superman from beginning, middle, and end, which means death of Superman, the stories we told in World Without of Superman, which came right after that, as well as The Reign of the Superman, which, you know, four characters came back and claimed to be Superman. Mm-hmm. I don't know that it has ever really gotten adequate credit for the critical success it was either. I think we've been, you know, poorly served there. Beyond that, in terms of pride on Superman, there are a couple of things. I think that I did a number of standalone stories. You know, everyone thinks of back then of the Superman books, there were either three or four titles, depending on what year you look at, as being connected into one almost weekly comic book. We also did a lot of things on our own, and I have a number of individual stories that I still look back on very fondly. The other thing is, we, you know, even before the death of Superman, we turned it into a success. And obviously we picked up, I think, a pretty good lead-in from John Byrne, who had kind of redone the titles at DC, you know, a year and a half prior to my coming out of the books. But I think we made Superman a sales success and raised the level of consciousness of Superman throughout the marketplace overall. You know, even today, if I go to a convention, I'm going to get three people almost at every convention who are going to come up to me and say, you know, with the death of Superman that got me into reading comics, that's where I started. And so I think that as I look at it, the job of any creator on a title, hopefully, is to leave the book better off than when he got there. And I think we did that with Superman. And, you know, during the, 12 years maybe that I was affiliated with the books, I think the character did right by us.
Now, another character who, right at the very heart of the, as you say, the grim and gritty times, who were undergoing great changes that you worked on, was Spider-Man. Your run on Sensational Spider-Man was, it was comparatively brief, and it came at a particularly controversial point in the character's history. What was working on the infamous Clone Saga like?
Well, you know, probably wasn't the story that I should have been doing. When when Marvel asked me to come and do Spider-Man, I had some awareness that they were going to be doing the clone story. And certainly that they were going to take and put some energy into that. What I thought we were going to do and what they wanted to do was, you know, typical Spider-Man stories. And for me, I have what I thought at that time was a pretty good idea of what a Spider-Man story would be, in that I won't say it mattered whether it was Peter Parker or Ben Reilly, but the components to a good Spider-Man story, I think, exist whether it's Peter Parker or Ben Reilly. I mean, either way, you can make a good, strong story. What I didn't want to tell was the clone story. That had started before I got there. As far as I was concerned, it was always somebody else's story. They started it, and, you know, they knew what they wanted to do with it, and that's fine. And what I wanted to do was tell, I think, good, fun, high-energy Spider-Man stories. And I don't think that was the same goal that Marvel had at that time, and we probably just were a little bit of the square peg and round hole type thing, that I felt that I couldn't tell the stories that I wanted to tell and was getting frustrated, and I think they were probably getting frustrated with me because they wanted to go in a different direction. I know that, you know, in terms of the clone stuff, I couldn't get out of it fast enough. Yeah, I just, yeah, I hadn't started it. I, you know, it's never good to have a writer come in on something like that sort of in the middle of the movie, if you will. So it was probably just not quite the right match at the time.
What would you do if you could go back and just be free of the constraints of that that period? I'm trying to phrase this in a sort of gentle manner. What would you do now that you couldn't do then?
You mean with regards to Spider-Man, or
yes?
Actually, I think Marvel has taken care of a lot of that. I mean, clearly. It's not, you know, they're not dealing with Ben Reilly anymore, you know, and I think by doing away with the, you know, the Peter Parker and Mary Jane wedding and everything else, that they have tried their best to address that. So, you know, I think you could do now what I probably would have done, wanted to do more of then. The difference is, of course, that, see, for me, I never thought that a wedding between Peter Parker and Mary Jane made a lot of sense. To me, Peter Parker always had to pay a price for being Spider-Man, which meant he didn't get the girl. Once you're Peter Parker and you marry, you know, a hot-ass fashion model, you know, all of a sudden you're not paying the price to be Spider-Man anymore. And to me, it was always a question of Spider-Man is out over the city. He's locked in a tremendous battle, and meanwhile, he's got two places where he has to be as Peter Parker. He's got a bottle of medicine for Aunt May in his belt, you know, tucked away or webbed to a building someplace, and he's got a date with Mary Jane. And by the time he gets done beating up the bad guy, he can only go to one place. And, of course, he misses his date with Mary Jane Watson. She walks off with Flash Thompson. Therefore, he saved Aunt May but paid the price for being Spider-Man.
Yeah.
I think it's interesting to hear you just advocate the erasure of the marriage, given how much of a hot-button topic that's been over the last couple of years.
Well, I don't know that I'm advocating it as much as I'm getting into the idea that, you know, I'm not advocating it because I didn't work on it, and I don't know the considerations that went into it and don't want to cast aspersions on it. The idea is, at its core, I always thought Peter Parker had to pay a price to be Spider-Man. You can still do that and have him marry Mary J. Watson and have them, you know, married and together. It's just harder to have that happen when Mary Jane Watson is a glamorous fashion model. You know, because she's not paying as much of a price at that point. At its essence, though, you can still do, you know, a good Spider-Man story even with all of that. It's, you know, there's any good character has certain components that go into making that character work. And I think those are some of the components that go into making Spider-Man work. But I'm not doing it, so I probably shouldn't even be talking about it.
That's okay.
Well, sticking with Marvel in the 90s, although we were moving out of the 90s, it was, just generally speaking, as you say, it was a time when Marvel had they'd ended the Clone Saga. They'd caught themselves on, essentially. They'd understood that these things weren't working right. This time period was a little too grim for its own good, and things started to change with the Heroes Reborn and Heroes Return era, when things just started to get a little shinier and a little happier. And it was around then that you started writing, which is, well, frankly, one of the best, if I may editorialize, one of the most entertaining and daring runs on Thor. That was some of my earliest exposure to Thor as a character, and still one of the runs I hold up as one of the greatest Thor runs now. Was writing Thor more challenging than writing for other characters, given the existing rich mythology of that world?
Yeah. it wasn't. You know, the funny thing is, here's what attracted me to doing Thor, because Marvel had actually offered me Thor like 3 years earlier, and I maybe even four somewhere in there, and I said, no, I don't think so. What Marvel had with Thor at that point that was tremendously attractive was a clean start.
Mm.
Thor hadn't been published for a few years because the Image guys had been off doing many of the Marvel characters. I don't think they did a Thor book.
No, they didn't.
But still, Marvel hadn't been publishing Thor either. So what we had was a clean start, where you know you're probably going to get a lot of new readers. But, you know, if there's one writer on issue, say, 477 of a title, and then you start with 478, you almost always have to, like, deal with some of the hanging threads or storylines or something that were there some way, somehow. There's a preconceived notion in the marketplace, whatever.
Hmm.
What we had at that point was a clean slate, which meant we could start to build from the ground up. We didn't do away with any Thor history, but we still treated it in many respects as though the book really hadn't been published before, you know? And so I think that made it easier for readers to access us. I did, you know, I might have used the Destroyer, for example, fairly, you know, right away, but it wasn't in reference to a particular earlier Destroyer story. For the people who liked the Destroyer, yeah, they got to see him again. If they didn't like him, well, you know, they might want to find out about him, or he would at least feel fresh. So it was a tremendously attractive place to start. That's my long-winded way of saying that we had the best of both worlds. We had previous Thor history and continuity, which was really some wonderful stuff, but we weren't, you know, chained to it in having to do particular and certain things to make it work. We could do what we wanted to do.
Out of curiosity, and this is just my curiosity now, the central conceit of your Thor when it began was that the other Asgardians were missing and that the Nine Realms were in chaos. But this had all been introduced during Kurt Busiek's and George Perez's earlier issues of Avengers, because the other titles that had been farmed out to Image came back to Marvel a little sooner than Thor did. So did those ideas come from you originally, and they were seeded through Avengers before the beginning of your series, or?
No, as I understand it, and I could be wrong on this is only what I had been told, because I was not involved in that decision. What I had been told at that time was that was a decision that was made at an editorial level, just so they wouldn't have to say, this is exactly where Thor and the Asgardians are and all that other stuff. That Marvel wanted to provide that blank slate to whoever was going to do Thor. And I think that was a real good decision, because really it gave us a little bit of a mystery to start out with as well. It's important to note, I think, that the one thing I really wanted to do right from issue one was play up the notion that Thor is really a god. He's not just a superhero. He's a god. And, you know, if you go, it's funny that there were some people in Marvel editorial at that time who thought that Thor's time had maybe come and gone, that it wasn't going to work anymore. Because when Stan and Jack first did Thor in the 60s, obviously a hero walking around with long hair and calling himself a god, that was really different stuff at that time. You know, since then, virtually every other character in comics at one time or another referred to himself a god or became one, especially the villains. So it didn't, you know, people thought it might not feel as fresh. But right from square one, I wanted to refer to Thor as the god, and have that be part of the dialogue, so that if he landed in the streets of New York City, people would say, you know, he called himself a god. You think he really is? No, he can't be. You know, and just get it out on the table and make that a part of the book. And we started with that right from square one.
And, of course, that became the driving force of the plot later.
Yes, it did. And it originally was, you know, slated to be part of the backdrop. But like any good subplot or what appears to be, you know, sort of the backdrop or background of a story, it started to bubble to the surface.
So I've got one last Thor question. I'm lingering on Thor terribly. This will be the last one. Just one thing I do have to wonder. You were on Thor for 6 years, more or less, and it really seemed like you were auguring in to bring things, the whole reigning, the whole alternate future, the huge story, to a conclusion with the 75th issue. But then that little thing, Avengers Disassembled, happened, and I always just wondered, at the very end, just like at the last hurdle, did they truncate you a little bit?
Yes.
Oh, grumble.
You know, we had certainly had plans to go forward with things that were going to happen. You know, I had written up a lot of it. You know, we had taken Thor to such an extreme that obviously, I won't say he had to pay for his sins necessarily, but we took him far enough that we then had to pull him back. And, you know, in what I always refer to it as, Thor has to do penance. He has to show remorse for what he had done. He had to atone for some of what he had done, which was really just about, you know, damn near a global takeover. And that he had to be humanized again. So whereas I spent, you know, that 6 years sort of bringing Thor to a very particular and logical conclusion, then we had to start, I think, to unwind that, and it was sort of pulling back from the brink, and we had, you know, every intention of going further with that, and then it was decided that that was not going to happen. So, and the interesting thing is, a lot of the stuff that I wrote about and set up, which was, for example, Don Blake was going to come back and be a very big part of the book. Thor was going to have to be on Earth in a different sort of capacity again, and Don Blake would be used to humanize him, all that stuff. They ended up doing several years later.
I just think it was such a good thing that Thor just went out on that high note with you, and then they stuck a pin in him for a good number of years, and it was all good memories of Thor's, and it really made people sit up and go, where is Thor? And it's something that I realized is that for as long as I've been reading Thor, and I'm a comparative newbie, I only really started, being in Ireland, I only started like collecting and reading imported American Marvel comics with the Heroes Reborn stuff, so, you know, about 14 or 15 years now at this point. For the length of time I've been reading Thor, it's just been a consistently excellent book. And, you know, you're a big part of that.
Well,
so,
thank you.
I thank you for Thor. Okay, I'm gonna stop geeking out about Thor now. JD.
No problem.
You go.
So I want to come back around to Booster. I know we don't have a lot of time left. So maybe tell us a little bit about maybe how your vision of the character has changed from maybe the time that they started, the time, you know, Booster was first created, to where he's at now, and then what's upcoming for the character.
I don't know that my vision of the character has changed per se. Because if you go back to the original run of the character, as we got into issues like 23, 24, and 25, the way I ended the book was to say, you know, we made this very sort of strong declaration where we ended kind of with the Rip Hunter storyline, and we flat out said that Booster Gold was going to evolve into an incredibly important character in the DC universe. That was like in, you know, the theme of the last two issues. And he had, within his own book, become less commercial by that point, okay? And that's where I had gotten him. What changed, I think, for people is what they were then exposed to for the next, you know, 10 years probably, was Booster Gold as a member of the Justice League. And the Justice League in the 80s, subsequent to that, took on a very lighthearted tone, and Booster and Blue Beetle were kind of turned into the, you know, the jokesters of the DC universe. So I think we sort of set it up in Booster Gold, Volume 1, then it kind of unwound a little bit in Justice League. And then when Jeff Katz and Jeff Johns wanted to come back and pick up the book, and they had Booster Save the Multiverse in 52, and then spun off his own title again, which I drew at first, that it was sort of picking up what was there already. And because he's a time traveler now, evolving into a time master, he's starting to take on the attributes and importance that we set up for him back in 1987 on into 88.
It wasn't your original intention for Rip Hunter to be his dad, was it?
No, that is something that
sorry, the other way around.
Came up with, and it's really a lot of fun. I think it's worked very well.
Like I said, it was just announced that you're going to be taking back over Booster with issue 44, and that's also going to – he's also going to be playing a role in Flashpoint. What can you tell us, if anything, about what we can expect out of Booster as far as his role in Flashpoint?
At this point, I cannot tell you a lot, I'm afraid.
I understand.
He will be dead center – really mixed up in it, let's put it that way, and will be playing a strong role. It's probably the safest thing I can say at this point. Obviously, with Flashpoint, we're letting details out, in dribs and drabs, a little bit here and a little bit there, and I think all in all, it's going to end up being a real fun read and a fun event for readers this summer. But obviously, we want them to read about it then and not hear about it so far in the future.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Flashpoint is being played very close to the chest thus far. We're just trying to see what we can get out of it.
Of course.
And of course, I'd be angry with myself if I didn't ask. Can we expect maybe to see, or can you say if we're going to see a return of the Black Beetle again as a part of Flashpoint? Or
not maybe so much as a part of Flashpoint, but obviously there are a lot of questions hanging in the air surrounding the Black Beetle, and a lot of things we still have yet to address. So you will see him when the time is right.
Excellent. I have my own theory, but I'm going to keep it.
Very enigmatic.
Well, I think that's about all the time that we have. Dan, I want to thank you again for joining us. And again, for my part, I'm a huge Booster fan, so I really appreciate everything that you've done on the series, and we definitely look forward to reading your work on Booster again, starting with 44.
Any final words for the listeners out there?
Well, I don't know that this is necessarily emphasizes anything, but as they read Booster Gold 44, if you look at page 4, panel 2, I was drawing it throughout this entire conversation. So,
fantastic.
When the book comes out, you guys can look at it, Booster 44, page 4, panel 2, and say, oh, he was drawing that while we were doing the interview. Cool. So there you go.
Well, thank you so much again. Thanks for being here, and maybe we'll try and talk to you again later on, maybe after Flashpoint or something.
Sure. Just shoot me an email.
All right. Great. Thanks, Dan.
Okay. You got it, guys. My pleasure.
This has been Fanboy Versus with your hosts, J.D. Church, Chris McFeely, and Chris Triplett. Visit us at tfradio.net for show notes and to subscribe to the podcast. Follow us on Twitter at TF Radio for news and updates. Like the podcast? Leave us feedback on iTunes. Copyright 2010, Radio Free Cybertron.